Discerning Hearts presents The Ascent of Mount Carmel by St. John of the Cross. Translated by David Lewis and read by Ed Humble. Book 3, Chapter 7, speaks of the evils inflicted on the soul by the knowledge of supernatural things if reflected upon. Their number.
The spiritual man exposes himself to five kinds of evils, if he attends to and reflects on that knowledge and those forms which are impressed upon his mind by the things which pass through it in a supernatural way. The first is frequent illusions, mistaking one thing for another. The second is proximate occasions of presumption or vainglory. The third is the opportunities of deceiving, which they furnish to the devil. The fourth is impediments to union with God in hope. The fifth is low views of God, for the most part. As to the first evil, it is clear that if the spiritual man attends to and reflects upon these notions and forms, he must be frequently deceived in his judgment about them. For, as no man can thoroughly comprehend what passes in the order of nature into his imagination, or have a sound and certain opinion about it, much less will he be able to decide correctly about supernatural things, which are beyond our understanding and of rare occurrence. He will frequently attribute to God what is after all but fancies, and to the evil spirit what is from God, and to God what is from Satan. Very frequently, good or evil to others or to himself will be present to him through these forms or figures, and he will consider them most certain and true. Yet they are nothing less than utterly false. Other impressions made upon him he will consider false, although they are true. This, however, I consider the safer course of the two, for it usually proceeds out of humility. But if he is not deceived as to their truth, he may be as to their kind and the value to be set upon them. He may look upon that which is trifling as important, and on what is important as trifling. And as to their quality, he may consider what his imagination presents to him to be of this or that kind, when it is not, putting darkness for light, and light for darkness, bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. Finally, if he escapes delusion in one thing, it will be surprising if he does in the next. For even if he abstains from determining anything in the matter, it is sufficient if he attends to it at all to bring some detriment upon himself, if not the precise one of which I am now speaking, yet some one of the others, of which I shall immediately speak. The duty, therefore, of the spiritual man is, if he wishes to escape from the delusions of his own judgment, not to decide himself upon his own state or feelings, or what such visions, knowledge, or impressions may mean. He ought not to desire to know anything about them, nor give heed to them, except for the purpose of manifesting them to his confessor, that he may learn from him how to empty his memory of these apprehensions, and what in every case may be most expedient for him, in the same spirit of detachment. For be these things what they may, they cannot help us to love God so much as the least act of earnest faith and hope done in the emptiness of all things.
Book 3, Chapter 8 reflects of the second evil, the danger of self-conceit and presumption.
These supernatural apprehensions of the memory, if attended to or regarded at all, are to spiritual men occasions of vanity or presumption. For as he who has no experience of them is exceedingly free from this vice, because he sees nothing in himself whereon to presume, so on the other hand he, to whom they are familiar, has an ever-present reason for thinking himself to be something, seeing that he is the object of these visitations. It is very true that he may attribute all to God and give thanks, looking upon himself as utterly unworthy. Nevertheless, a certain self-satisfaction and conceit on the subject of these apprehensions will grow up in the mind, out of which, unawares, great spiritual pride will arise. Men might see this very clearly, if they would but reflect on that feeling of dislike and aversion produced in them by those who do not commend their spirit or attribute no value to their experiences, and on that feeling of distress which they have when they are told that others also have the like or greater gifts. All this is the fruit of secret self-esteem and pride, and they cannot be made to understand that they are steeped in it up to their very eyes. They think that a certain recognition of their own wretchedness is sufficient, while at the same time they are filled with secret self-esteem and personal satisfaction, taking more delight in their own spirit and gifts than in those of another. They are like the Pharisee who thanked God that he was not as the rest of men, and that he practiced such and such virtues. He was satisfied with himself, and presumed upon his state. O God, I give thee thanks, said he, that I am not as the rest of men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers. I fast twice in a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. Now these men do not say this in so many words as the Pharisee did, but they habitually think so, and some of them even become so proud as to be worse than devils. When they are conscious of certain feelings and devotional sweetness in the things of God, as they imagine, they become so self-satisfied that they look upon themselves as most near unto God, and upon others, unconscious of the like feelings, as most unworthy, and they despise them, as the Pharisee did the publican. To avoid this pestilent evil, abominable in the sight of God, there are two considerations to help us. The first is that virtue does not consist in these apprehensions, however sublime they may be, nor in any personal experiences of this kind, but, on the contrary, in that which is not matter of feeling at all, in great humility, contempt of ourselves and all that belongs to us, profoundly rooted in the soul, in being glad that others have the same opinion of us, and in not wishing to be thought well of by others at all. The second is that all visions, revelations, and heavenly feelings, and whatever else is greater than these, are not worthy the least act of humility, bearing the fruits of that charity which neither values nor seeks itself, which thinketh no evil except of self, and which thinketh well not of self, but of others. Let men, therefore, cease to regard these supernatural apprehensions, and labor rather to forget them, that they may be free.
Book 3, Chapter 9, speaks of the third evil, the work of the devil through the imaginary apprehensions of the memory.
From what I have already written, we may gather and learn how great is that evil which the devil inflicts on the soul through these supernatural apprehensions. Not only can he represent to the memory and the fancy many false notions and forms which shall seem good and true, impressing them on the mind and senses with great effect and certainty by his suggestions, and this in such a way as to make his representations be taken for what they pretend to be. For, as he changes himself into an angel, he will seem to be light to the soul. But also in the very truths of God he can tempt us in divers ways, by communicating unruly motions about them to our desires and affections, whether spiritual or sensual. For if the soul takes pleasure in these apprehensions, it is very easy for Satan to increase our affections and desires, and to plunge us into spiritual gluttony and other evils. And that he may succeed the better, he is wont to inspire and fill the senses with delight, sweetness, and pleasure in the things of God, so that the soul, dazzled and enervated by that sweetness, may become blind through pleasure, and set itself more upon sweetness than upon love, at least not so much upon love, and attach greater importance to these apprehensions than to that detachment and emptiness which are to be found in faith and hope and the love of God. He doeth all this that, starting from that point, he may, by little and little, delude the soul and bring it to believe, with great readiness, all his lies. For the soul that is blind considers falsehood to be a falsehood no longer, evil not to be evil, because it puts darkness for light, and light for darkness, and falls into endless disorders. That which was once wine is turned to vinegar, as well in the natural as in the moral and spiritual order. All this comes upon the soul, because it did not, in the beginning, deny itself in the pleasure ministered by supernatural things. And, as this pleasure was at first not great or not so hurtful, the soul was not sufficiently afraid of it, but suffered it to remain and grow, as the grain of mustard grows into a great tree. For a slight error in the beginning becomes a great error in the end. The soul that will escape this evil, the work of the devil, must not take any pleasure in these apprehensions, for if it does, the result will most certainly be blindness, and then a fall. For delight and sweetness, of their own proper nature, brutalize and blind the soul. This is the meaning of David when he said, "Perhaps darkness shall cover me, and night shall be my light in my pleasures." That is, "Perhaps darkness shall cover me in my pleasures, and I shall take night for my light."
Book 3, Chapter 10 speaks of the fourth evil of the distinct supernatural apprehensions of the memory, the impediment to union.
Section 59 of The Ascent of Mount Carmel by St. John of the Cross. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Book 3, Chapter 10 of the fourth evil of the distinct supernatural apprehensions of the memory, the impediment to union. There is not much to be said here about the fourth evil, because I have been speaking of it throughout this book. I have said that the soul, in order to be united with God in hope, must renounce all possession in the memory, because nothing that is not God must remain in the memory, if our hope in God is to be perfect. No form or figure or image, natural or supernatural, of which the memory takes cognizance, can be or resemble God, as it is written, "There is none among the gods like unto thee, O Lord." And therefore, if the memory dwells upon any such, it impedes the divine union, in the first place, because it perplexes itself, and in the next, because the greater its occupation, the less perfect is hope. It is therefore necessary for the soul to forget and detach itself from all distinct forms and knowledge of supernatural things, that it may not impede in the memory the divine union in perfect hope.
Book 3, Chapter 11 speaks of the fifth evil resulting from the imaginary supernatural apprehensions, low and unseemly views of God.
The fifth evil is no less hurtful to the soul. It flows from the willing retention in the imaginative memory of the forms and images of those things which are supernaturally communicated to the soul, but especially then when we would apply them as means to the divine union. It is a very easy thing for us to form notions about the nature and greatness of God, unworthy of and unbecoming His incomprehensible being. Though our reason and judgment may withhold us from forming any express decision that God is like any one of these similitudes, still the mere consideration of these apprehensions generates in the soul a certain esteem and sense of God which are not so high as faith teaches, namely, that He transcends all comparison and all comprehension. For over and above that, the soul takes from God that which it gives to the creature. The mere consideration of these apprehensions naturally produces within it a certain comparison of them with God, which will not leave it to judge of God as it ought to do. For, as I have said before, no creature whatever, in heaven or on earth, no forms or images, natural or supernatural, cognizable by our faculties, however noble they may be, present any comparison or proportion with the being of God, because neither genus nor species includes Him. And in this life, the soul of man is incapable of comprehending clearly and distinctly anything that cannot be classed under genus and species. This is why St. John said, "No man hath seen God at any time." And Isaiah and St. Paul, "Neither hath it entered into the heart of man." Yea, God Himself hath said, "Man shall not see me and live." He, therefore, who shall perplex his memory and the other powers of his soul with matters that they can comprehend, will never think and feel about God as he ought to do. I will explain my meaning by a somewhat low comparison. The more we fix the eyes of our regard upon the courtiers of a king, and the more we consider them, the less will be our reverence and respect for that king. For even if our disesteem of him be not formally and distinctly recognized by the intellect, it is nevertheless visible in our conduct. The more we attribute to the courtiers, the more we rob their king. And we cannot have a high opinion of that king, then, because his courtiers are so respected in his presence. This is the soul's treatment of God, whenever the soul gives heed to these apprehensions. This illustration is of a very mean one. For God is of another nature than all his creatures, infinitely different from them all. These apprehensions, therefore, must be put out of sight, and the eyes must regard none of them, but be fixed upon God in faith and perfect hope. Hence those who not only give heed to these apprehensions, but also think that God is like unto some of them, and that by their help they may attain union with Him, they are already fallen into grievous error. They do not profit by the light of faith and the intellect, which is the means by which this faculty is united with God. Neither also will they grow up to the heights of hope, which is the means of union for the memory. That union must be effected by the severance of the memory from all imaginations whatever.
Book 3, Chapter 12, speaks of the benefits of withdrawing the soul from the apprehensions of the imagination. It answers an objection, the difference between the natural and supernatural imaginary apprehensions.
The benefits that result from emptying the imaginative faculty of these imaginative forms become manifest by the consideration of the five evils which they inflict on the soul, if it would retain them, as I said before, of the natural forms. But, beside these benefits, there are others of perfect rest and tranquility of mind. For, putting aside that natural rest which the soul enjoys when it has set itself free from the dominion of images and forms, it is also delivered from the anxiety of ascertaining whether they are good or evil, and what conduct it ought to observe with reference to one and the other. It also escapes from troubling and wasting the time of its confessors, for it does not require them to determine whether these things are good or evil, or the nature of them, matters the knowledge of which is not necessary for it, for all it has to do is to reject them, in the sense I have already explained, and to give no attention whatever to them. The time and strength thus wasted, will be then employed in a better and more profitable way, in conforming the will to God, in earnestly striving after detachment, poverty of sense and spirit, which consists in a willing, real privation of all consoling and tangible support, interior as well as exterior. This we practice well when we seek and strive to separate ourselves from these forms, the issue of which will be that inestimable blessing of drawing near unto God, who has neither image, form, nor figure. And that blessing will be proportional to our estrangement from all forms, images, and figures. You will here perhaps object, and say, why then do many spiritual directors counsel us to profit by these divine communications and impressions, and to desire the gifts of God, that we may have wherewithal to give to Him in return? For if He gives nothing, we too have nothing to give unto Him. Why does St. Paul say, extinguish not the Spirit? Why does the bridegroom say to the bride, put me as a seal upon thy heart, as a seal upon thy arm? This seal signifies some apprehensions. And yet, according to this teaching, we are not only not to seek them, but even if God sends them, to reject them. It is also certain that God, when He sends them for our good, and that their effects will be good. Pearls are not to be thrown away. Yea, it is even a sort of pride not to yield a willing reception to God's communications, as if we could do without them in our own strength. I refer the reader, for the solution of this difficulty, to the 15th and 16th chapters of the second book, where the objection has been, in great measure, replied to. I said there that the benefits of the supernatural apprehensions, when they are from God, are passively wrought in the soul, at the time of their presentation to the senses, without the cooperation of our faculties. An act of the will admitting them is therefore unnecessary, for, as I have said, if the soul will then exert its own faculties, the effect of that natural and inferior exertion will be to impede the supernatural effects then wrought by God through their intervention, rather than any profit from that active exertion. Yea, rather, inasmuch as the fruit of these imaginary apprehensions is passively communicated to the soul, so the soul on its part must be passively disposed in their regard without any interior or exterior acts, as I have already explained. This is really to preserve the divine impressions, for by this conduct we shall not destroy them by inferior actions of our own. This, too, is the way not to extinguish the Spirit, for we should extinguish Him if we attempted to walk in a way along which God does not lead us. We should be doing that if, when God communicates His Spirit to us passively, as He does in these apprehensions, we should then actively exert our intellect, or seek anything in them beside and beyond that which God communicates through them. This is evident. For if the soul then exerts itself, its action will be only natural, or at the utmost, if supernatural, far inferior to that which God wills. In its own strength, the soul cannot do more, seeing that it neither does nor can influence itself supernaturally. It is God that so influences it, but with its own consent. If, then, the soul will do anything itself, it will necessarily, so far as itself is concerned, impede the communication of God, that is, the Spirit, because it has recourse to its own operations, which are of another kind and far inferior to those of God. This, then, is to extinguish the Spirit. The inferiority of this exertion is clear, for the powers of the soul, in their ordinary and natural course, cannot act or reflect but upon some figure, form, or image, and these are but the rind and accidents of the substance of the Spirit hidden beneath them. This substance and Spirit unite not with the powers of the soul in true intelligence and love, until the reflex and imperfect action of those powers shall have ceased. The end aim of the soul in this exertion is to receive in itself the substance, understood and loved, which those forms involve. The difference, therefore, between the active and passive operation and the superiority of the latter is the same as that between a work in the course of performance and the same work already performed, between the search after an object and that object sought and found. If the soul, then, will actively exert its faculties on those supernatural apprehensions in which God, as I have said, communicates passively the spirit of them, it will do nothing else but forsake what is already done, in order to do it anew, and so it will have no enjoyment of it, neither will its own exertions have any other effect than to frustrate what God hath wrought. Because, as I have said, the powers of the soul can never of themselves attain to the spirit, which God communicates independently of them. If we were to attach any importance to these imaginary apprehensions, we should directly extinguish the spirit which God infuses through them into the soul. We must therefore put them aside, and observe a passive conduct in their regard, for God is then lifting up the soul to things above its power and its knowledge. This is the meaning of the prophet when he said, I will stand upon my watch and fix my foot upon the tower, and I will watch to see what will be said of me. That is, I will keep guard over my faculties and will not suffer them to move a step, and so shall I be able to see what will be said to me. That is, I shall understand and enjoy what God will communicate to me supernaturally. As to the objection, founded on the words of the bridegroom, whose words refer to that love which he demands, the function of which is to make the beloved ones resemble each other. And therefore he saith to her, Put me as a seal upon thy heart. Where the arrows strike that are shot forth from the quiver of love, that is, the actions and motives of love, so that all the arrows of love might strike him, being there as a target for them, and that all may thus reach him, and the soul become like unto him through the actions and motives of love, until it becomes transformed in him. He also says, As a seal upon thy arm. The arm implies the exercise of love, for it is that which comforts and sustains the beloved. Therefore all we have to do with these apprehensions, which come upon us from above, as well imaginary as of every other kind, whether visions, locutions, impressions, or revelations, is, making no account of the letter or the outward veil, that is, the significative and intelligible fact, to attend only to the preservation of the love of God, which they cause interiorly in the soul. It is in this sense that we are to make much of these impressions, not of the sweetness and the light of them, nor of the figures, but of the impressions of love which produce it. And with this object only in view, we may probably at times call to mind that image and apprehension which have been the occasion of love, in order to furnish ourselves with motives of love. For though the effect of that apprehension be not so great when recalled to mind as it was when first communicated, still at the recollection of it our love is renewed, and our minds elevated unto God, especially when the recollection is of one of those supernatural images, figures, or impressions which usually so impress themselves on the soul that they continue for some time there, and can scarcely be driven away. These images, thus imprinted on the soul, produce, whenever they are adverted to, the divine effects of love, sweetness, and light, sometimes more, sometimes less, for that is the end for which they are impressed. He with whom God thus deals receives a great gift, for he has a mine of blessings within himself. The images which produce such effects as these are vividly grounded in the spiritual memory, and resemble not those which the fancy preserves. It is not therefore necessary, when we would remember them, to have recourse to the fancy, because we have them in ourselves, as an image seen in a mirror. and whenever a soul has them formally, it may then profitably recall them to that effect of love, because they will not impede the union of love in faith when we do not dwell upon them, but make use of them towards exciting our love, and, when that is done, instantly dismiss them. In this way they will be of service to us towards the attainment of the divine union. It is difficult to determine when these images touch directly the spiritual part of the soul, and when they are only in the fancy. Those of the fancy are usually very frequent, for the imagination and the fancy of some people are full of imaginary visions, abundantly present in one form. Whether it be the result of the great vigor of that organ which, after the slightest effort of thought, represents at once and portrays in the fancy the usual forms, whether it be the work of Satan, or whether it be the work of God, but not formally impressed on the soul. But however, we may determine their nature by their effects. Those that are natural or diabolic in their origin, however accurately remembered, produce no good effect. Neither do they spiritually renew the soul, and the recollection of them issues only in dryness. While those that are from God produce, whenever remembered, some good effect, as at the first when originally presented to the soul. The formal images, those which are impressed on the soul, almost always when remembered, produce some effect. He who has these will easily distinguish the one from the other, for the difference between them will be most evident after experience. I have one thing, however, to say. Those which are formally and durably impressed on the soul are of very rare occurrence. But of whatever kind they may be, the good of the soul consists in not seeking to comprehend anything, save God alone, by faith, in hope. Finally, as to that objection which charges him with pride, who rejects these things when they are good, I reply that it is a prudent humility to use them in the best way, as I have shown, and to guide our steps by the road that is safest.